I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Kurt Schmoke was Baltimore's first elected African-American mayor. He served from 1987 to 1999, a long and hard period in the city's history, with the arrival of crack cocaine, a rise in violence, and significant losses in the city's population. Kurt Schmoke, now president of the University of Baltimore, shares his perspective on life in the city since he left office and since Freddie Gray's death and April's riot. What does he make of the city's elected officials and their performance under pressure? What should be the priorities of Baltimore's present and future mayors? We'll also hear about a course being offered at UB this fall, Divided Baltimore. How did we get here? Where do we go? Former Baltimore Mayor Kurt Schmoke on Midday, after the news from NPR. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Good afternoon. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. In the second hour of our show today, it's Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. She joins us once a month. Today, we'll be talking about swimming holes. Are they safe to swim in the creeks and tributaries of the Chesapeake Bay? Rona has some insight on the conditions of local swimming holes during the summer. Also, in this month's edition of Midday on the Bay, the slaughter of an unloved Chesapeake native, the Cow-Nose Ray, it raises questions. We have a story to tell you about that involves a video of a tournament of bow hunters killing this animal, the Cow-Nose Ray, back in June, killing a lot of them, raising questions about whether that is sport or some type of depravity. But it also highlights the need for more information about the ray's behavior and its impact on bay shellfish. One of the reasons sportsmen are encouraged to kill this animal is because it likes to eat oysters. So we'll be talking about that in the second hour today with Rona Cabell. Also on oysters, we'll meet a young man from Baltimore who's raising oysters in the bay, and we'll hear from an older guy who's trying to kayak the entire Delmarva Peninsula all the way around in 30 days. That's coming up in the second hour of our show today. In this first hour, we talk about Baltimore with Kurt Schmoke, who was Baltimore's first elected African-American mayor. He served as mayor of this city from 1987 to 1999. He is now president of the University of Baltimore. This fall, UB is offering a course called Divided Baltimore. How did we get here? Where do we go? So that occasions the visit of Kurt Schmoke. It's great to have him anytime on our show because so much is going on in Baltimore today, so much to talk about. Kurt Schmoke, nice to have you back on the show.
Thanks, Dan. Great to be here. And
to call you Mayor Schmoke, Dr. Schmoke, President Schmoke.
I told people when I got this new job, just call me Kurt.
Kurt.
That's consistent.
Well, it's nice to have you back here. Yeah. And I was thinking about you when I was writing my column in today's Sun. Mm-hmm. About a young fella in his early 30s, a father of three kids in Northwest Baltimore, who bought a house, owns a home. He's been there for 7 years. Just feels hammered by the drug scene up at the corner, almost constant. Feels intimidated by drug dealers who are out in the street all the time. He's frustrated with the police response to it. Anyway, and he's thinking about moving out of the city because of all this. And it reminded me of that time when you were mayor. We had several years of homicides over 300. We also had a great deal of population loss during your time as mayor.
You know, and the tough thing about it, I think about those years also. Reminds me that, you know, it's easy to lose your reputation, tough to gain it back. But, you know, during that same time when we had those bad problems, we also had some great things going on, you know, like building the two stadiums came up. We had the empowerment zone where Inner Harbor was being expanded. There really were a lot of very good things going on, but every day, 10 of the 12 years that I was mayor, we had over 300 homicides, and that was because of disruptions in the drug markets. And also, you recall we had that New York boys phenomenon, too, where they were leaving the metropolitan areas of New York coming down here. But what I see right now is that we started to make some changes, and the community and everybody came together, and we started to focus on solutions. And that's what we're going to do, this course that you mentioned. We're going to be talking about solutions. And I think that for that gentleman who has the home, that there are some really solutions to the problem, but it does involve community trust with working with the police. If there's no trust between the communities and the police, then we're going to be in bad shape for quite a while.
Well, looking at the death of Freddie Gray and all that's happened since then, and the focus on the relationship between police and citizens, and also the reports in the Sun about settlements that the city has reached,
right,
paying for damages as a result of police misconduct, excessive force. What about all of that? Because, I guess this was a problem. Our eyes are wide open to it now.
That's right.
It's been a problem for a long time.
Right.
How did it manifest during your time as mayor?
Well, one of the things, what happened is that the war on drugs, and I won't go through all of my critique of it.
You can. I mean, I welcome it. I was going to ask you about it again.
But that changed a lot of police practice. Police got very much more aggressive in their contacts with young people on the street, and sometimes it was indiscriminate. They didn't focus just on those who they really thought were bad, but if there's groups of young men on the street, they treated the whole group in the same way. There's if you want to see a movie, it's Straight Outta Compton. There's a scene in there where police approach a group of young men, get them all on the ground, and just so happened that they were coming from a taping of, recording of the music. Mm-hmm. And yet the police treated them all in the same way. And that was because of, police trying their best to get the drugs off the street. And unfortunately, that was one of the negative impacts of the war on drugs. They're now, doing things a little bit differently. But, when we started to move more towards community-oriented policing, when we had the PALS and the police athletic leagues, that too made a big difference. Having police officers meeting with young people in a setting that was very positive early on, so that the relationship, developed as a positive one, that made a difference. And so, it's a shame that budgetary constraints led to the cutback of the PAL program. But there are a lot of ways that I'm seeing now that we can really help solve the problem. And, I was particularly pleased, for example, that this group of young people started this Black Lives Matter effort, because they're getting involved. But the thing that I am hoping that they will do, which will expand it a little bit, is instead of just focusing on police contact with young people, the fact is, Dan, and I know it's controversial, but there are more Black young men killed by young Black men than are killed by police in years. I mean, and so that has to be a real focus. We've got to get more people in the community talking to police, giving anonymous tips. I'm not talking about being witnesses. I'm talking about a flow of information to the police so that the police can more readily target individuals who are involved with criminal activity rather than looking indiscriminately at all young people.
How do you get people over that, over the fear they
have? That's the trust issue.
That's the trust.
That's right.
A very big part of this. How do you get past that?
Well, because we're not talking about them being witnesses in cases. I understand the reservation about that. But right now, through better police training, getting officers on the street talking to people with respect, also commanders getting information out to some community leaders, that all we need is information. If police, let's say in a particular district, they get 10 calls, anonymous calls, that this particular house is a drug house or this particular person has guns that we know are illegal, it makes the job immensely better for police. And so getting that flow of information in a trustworthy manner is a big key to what's going on right now.
When you were mayor, how would you characterize your relationship with the Fraternal Order of Police, the rank-and-file police officers of the city? Do you think that they were invested in the city?
Well, you know, it's very interesting you asked that, because I did have an encounter with them. One of the things that the FOP, when I ran for mayor the first time, they endorsed my candidacy. They were very supportive. And over time, there were some tense moments, most of them related to salary negotiations. One of the biggest things that they wanted was a change in the pension system, because when I came into office, you had to be in there 30, 35 years before you could get full pension. And most cities were going to 20 and out,
right.
20 years and out. Right. And so I worked with the city council. They passed that bill. I signed it. So I thought, oh, I had done a good thing for the union. The very next election, they endorsed my opponent. So it wasn't one of hostility, but it was one of they had, among some of the leaderships, fairly narrow interests that they wanted taken care of. I mean, we're going to serve the city, but in terms of dealing with elected officials, they had very fairly narrow interests. If you didn't deal with that, then you had a cool relationship.
I ask about that because, you know, what's been going on here the last 3 months. This is sort of unprecedented to see, not sort of unprecedented, it is unprecedented to see six police officers charged in connection with the death of a person they had in their custody. And not yesterday, we have the announcement of charges against another police officer by the state's attorney in Baltimore.
But
in the last 3 months, some people would look at this and say, this isn't all just because of a change in the dynamics of how drugs are sold in Baltimore.
Right.
There's something else going on here. Arrests are down. The Fraternal Order of Police president has said that the officers are afraid to do their jobs, more afraid to do their jobs and go to jail
right.
Than they are being shot.
Well, I actually, had the issue yesterday, I thought was actually, you know, it may sound odd, but there was a positive sign in that the police commissioner came out with the state's attorney. And the first thing that they did was say that the shootings by the two officers were absolutely justified, even though the guy ended up, he didn't have a weapon, but they had reasonable fear of their lives, and they made it so clear. Then they distinguished that from the other guy
right.
who's standing over an unarmed, helpless, non-aggressive person and makes a shot. It was not just the, distinguishing the work of those officers, but it let me know that somebody in the police department actually went ahead and told what went on. That is, that this silence, or, you know, you don't talk about something that the other guy did,
mm-hmm.
that maybe that barrier is starting to come down, and the good police officers are understanding that we've got a minority, a tiny group of people that cause problems. Let's get them out of here and serve the citizens. So, you know, maybe I'm just more of an optimist, but I thought yesterday was a sign that we were starting to turn the corner.
I'm with you on
the
that.
Right direction.
What I'm concerned about, other citizens are concerned about, is whether the police generally are doing their jobs, or is this some sort of a protest of the charges against the Freddie Gray Six.
Yeah, I thought there was some initial slowdown in April and May. The numbers, in my view, supported that. But since then, I've seen the arrests have actually started to go up. The biggest problem now is these gangs and crews that are fighting one another and shooting one another. And I think that's why I said the police definitely need more information. The other thing that our community needs, you know, a lot of people are being released from prison. They're coming back into the community. There have been a number of folks that have tried to focus in on reentry programs. They're absolutely necessary, because if we don't have good reentry programs, then guys will come back, look for jobs, can't get jobs, go back on the street, and old wounds are opened again, and you hear retaliation. So there's a lot that can be done, and I think there's a lot that, particularly if the city and the state will work together, on this, that we can really start seeing these homicide numbers come down.
Kurt Schmoke is our guest in this hour of midday. I want to ask you one more question before we go to our first break, and we'll invite calls during this hour if you'd like to join me in the conversation with the former mayor of Baltimore, now president of the University of Baltimore. So when your name comes up frequently, and I was thinking of you again yesterday for two reasons. One, this middle-class homeowner thinking of leaving the city because of the fear of crime around his neighborhood. But also, what is that? What is the nature of that crime? These are men that I saw standing on a street corner waiting for a car to come up, go down an alley, exchange some cash for some drugs.
Right.
Right? That's what that's all about.
Right.
That's why this homeowner fears for his life or his kids' safety. He doesn't know who's carrying a gun, who isn't, what's going on in his neighborhood from time to time. Big crowds of strangers move in. They seem to be selling drugs. And it goes on and on and on, right?
Yep.
And it's all about drugs. It's all about the sale of these opiates, right?
Yeah.
And I know that when your name comes up, frequently people say, oh, yeah, he's the mayor who said, he's the mayor who was right. He's the mayor who said we should start thinking about decriminalizing some of these drugs that are sold in the black market, you know, illegally.
You got to take the profit out of distributing this stuff on the street level. And you don't do that by just more police work. I mean, there's the example of, you know, when we tried to become an alcohol-free America by making the possession and sale of alcohol illegal, we saw the terrible problems that that caused. So we decided to treat alcoholism as a public health problem. And that's all I'm saying with respect to drugs. There ought to be a war on drugs, but it ought to be a public health war rather than a criminal justice war.
But we ended prohibition. We ended prohibition. You and
right.
I can go buy some booze this afternoon.
That's right. And so we still have some problems. And what we make criminal is things like driving while intoxicated certain illegal sales. But generally, the simple possession of alcohol is no longer a crime, and as it was back in the 20s. So I think there's some lessons to be learned. One good thing I have to say is that I've been impressed that Governor Hogan and Lieutenant Governor Rutherford have looked at this heroin problem not just as a crime problem. They've been really talking about treatment options, and they look at it statewide. Heroin's become a problem not just inner city, but in the other counties and states. So I think people are beginning to look at the drug problem very differently, and we've got to recognize, though, that we still have to do more on decriminalization because the markets in the inner city are still profitable and people will be attracted to the profits.
How do we get this conversation started? Because most people would say if you continue to repeat behavior over and over again, you're just in a maddening cycle.
Yeah.
Nothing's going to change.
Right.
Right. So how do we begin to break this? I mean, I guess it's helpful that the Attorney General of the United States made some recommendations to start to break it. And the president of the United States has talked about the futility of it.
Yeah, and I was also, you know, there's a way of doing this on a bipartisan basis. It doesn't have to just be, you know, liberal Democrats talking about this. I would ask my, more conservative Republican friends to look at it as a pure cost-benefit basis. What, you know, look at the money that we put into this government program and look at the benefit. Is it working? Is it not? That's the way many of my colleagues on the Republican side look at other government programs. So I'd ask them to look at the war on drugs in the same way.
The cost of the war itself, the cost of incarceration, the cost to society generally.
That's right. And are we making any progress? And you know, unfortunately, when I started talking about this in 1988, I used to go to very skeptical crowds, and I would ask them three questions. I said, "Do you think we've won the war on drugs?" And then secondly, "Do you think we're winning?" And then third, "Do you think that doing more of the same will win?" And usually people would say, "No, no, no. We haven't won. We're not winning. Doing the same is not going to win." And so
okay, let's talk now about
alternatives. And unfortunately, those questions are still as valid in 2015 as they were in 1988.
That's right. And at the point you make, every one of them supported by polls that I read every year when Americans are polled on the war on drugs. 67 to 70% agree that those statements would say the same thing. All right, we'll take a break here and we would enjoy hearing from you, our listeners, if you have comments or questions for former Mayor Kurt Schmoke, now president of the University of Baltimore. And we'll be joined in a few minutes by Provost of UB, Joseph Wood, to tell us about this course that's being offered this fall, Divided Baltimore, How Did We Get Here? Where Do We Go? Our phone number is 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org, midday@wypr.org, for any comments or questions you'd like me to read on the air. And welcome back. Dan Rodericks here with Kurt Schmoke, former mayor of Baltimore, now president of the University of Baltimore, 410-662-8780. How do you think city leadership is holding up through this? What do you think of decisions that have been made, efforts that have been made in the last 3 or 4 months?
Well, I think that the mayor's on the right road. The clear problem right now is that there needs to be kind of a powwow involving the mayor and the governor to talk about working together. It's not new money that they need, but it's working in a complementary fashion so that there's not, you know, duplication. The resources are not great, but there's a role for the state, a role for the city. And if they can get together, I think a lot of progress will be made. For example, you know, this summer, there was this amazing increase in the number of jobs offered to young people.
8,000.
8,000. That's the community coming together. And that's the kind of thing that shows me that, you know, we really can solve some tough problems. But what I've seen, and particularly I was just recently in Sandtown, is that if we're going to make long-term success, these kinds of efforts have to be sustained. I rode through the community, and I could tell block by block some areas where we had made investments. In fact, all the way back to Governor Schaefer, when he was mayor, he tried on the west side, the west boundary of Sandtown, which is Fulton Avenue, to make some improvements. And you can see there's a couple of blocks
where
of homes.
Actually beautiful.
They're beautiful homes,
yeah.
But that was it.
That's it.
It stopped. And so I think he thought that it was going to be the catalyst to a further development. Then you go into Sandtown itself around Gilmore Street, and you see houses, the Nehemiah housing that we did. Right. During and then Mayor O'Malley did the ones on Pennsylvania Avenue, and Mayor Dixon did a group. So you see these signs of some hit and miss, and maybe we focused so much on the physical side and didn't do enough on the social side, and maybe that's a lesson
that's
that we
interesting
learned,
because the idea is new housing, fresher looking streets. Trees,
right.
All that ought to do it, right?
It ought to help.
But Sandtown ended up having, the highest concentration of incarcerated individuals in Maryland from that area.
That's right. And yet, if you go, there's some blocks in Sandtown that you kind of scratch your head and say, wait a minute, this doesn't look like what I'm seeing on the Freddie Gray news clips all the time, because there's nice houses with new homeowners. But I know a number of people that we helped through the Sandtown efforts actually moved out. They got the GED program, they got their high school degree, they got a step up, and they said, we're moving out. So it's a real mix, and I think that's the lesson that we learned from Sandtown, that just doing the physical development by itself wasn't enough. Now, we used that, some of those lessons, when we did the high-rises. You recall, Dan, that 20 years ago, the center of some of our criminal activity was the public housing high-rises. And we went to the community, talked to the folks. One of the things they said was blow them up, which we did. Mm-hmm. But then we planned with the community, and we were able to get new housing there, a mix of home ownership and rentals. But we also put in recreation programs. So you had police programs, and also changed the management so that people had a real interest, personal interest, and noticed that during this last group of riots in April, the areas that didn't riot were those areas where, you know, they had the new neighborhoods
right.
from there.
You
know, so
over where the Murphy homes used to be.
Yeah,
right.
So, you know, it's just a sign that, you know, working with the community, we can be successful. So I'm kind of optimistic that if we can get the various elements of government and the private sector kind of working together, and that's why this One Baltimore effort has to be sustained. If we stop, then we're going to just slip right back into the same problems.
I got two questions for you, then we'll go to the phone lines. One is, you know, you had to manage, in addition to all of that, yeah. trying to pull all that off,
right.
a shrinking city, a shrinking tax base,
yeah.
right? And you did a lot with what federal money was available then. And I remember William Donald Schaefer saying, you know, I'm going to Annapolis, I'm going to become governor. I love being mayor, but, you know, we're just not going to have as much money from the federal government to do things here.
Yep.
And I've heard other people say, you know, it's no fun being mayor because you just don't have the federal support we used to have for housing, for instance, yeah. for community redevelopment. Do you think that's still true? That takes...
Well,
I mean,
it does
just tougher to be mayor.
It makes it a little bit tougher. I mean, the first President Bush used to say to mayors that sometimes there's more will than wallet, and that's true. But what it requires now is partnerships. Got to work with the business community, got to work with our nonprofit organizations and with the state. And prioritize. Can't do everything. But, you know, other cities that were in Baltimore's situation, Jacksonville is an example, Indianapolis, they actually annexed, and that's helped them a great deal with their property base. Just think about, and I know people will go crazy.
You can't really do that here, right?
We can't anymore, no, because we changed the state constitution back.
But imagine what? Go ahead.
Imagine if our mayor, imagine if I could annex to the Beltway. If all the property that was in from the Beltway, you know, into the heart of town were part of Baltimore City, that would be a tax base that is very different in its makeup than what we have now. But that's dreaming. You can't get it done.
Right.
So absent that, what do you do? You've got to work with your major institutions, ask them to do certain things, government focus in on what it should do best, dealing with crime and grime and education. Those are the three things for local government, and try to get partnerships to handle all these other things.
And David Rusk's suggestion for Unbound Baltimore or Baltimore Unbound was to give people an opportunity, people who are in poverty,
yeah.
who remain in poverty after you take down the public housing projects, to move. Give them an opportunity to live in better neighborhoods where the schools are better, where
yeah.
maybe their kids can do better in you know, within a generation, make an improvement.
Well, even there, we found one of the lessons in the, you know, giving people a voucher and giving them opportunity to move is that there's still some training that has to be done first. You know, you can imagine if you're a family, you've lived in these big public housing high-rises, all you've done all your life in terms of just simple thing, trash, is take it over to a chute on a floor and dump it.
Right.
You know, and then all of a sudden we put you out in a neighborhood where you got to have a can and move it up.
And remember what day to do that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's a little thing, yeah. but it's the type of thing that where you need some training so that people in the new neighborhood don't say, oh, those people are bringing
Actually,
my neighborhood down.
Such an effort is underway as a result of that consent decree in federal court
right.
With the ACLU and HUD. To get people to better places
right.
using those vouchers.
And as long as you don't concentrate the poverty so that
right.
people don't point out that particular neighbor and say, oh, this is a problem child. You
right.
know, you do it in a planned manner. Again, it just takes some coordination.
410-662-8780. Let's take a couple of calls for former Mayor Kurt Schmoke. Connie in Charles Village, welcome to the show. Go right ahead, please.
Hi, I just wanted to thank Mayor Schmoke for having had the courage to be one of the very few politicians to express my belief that the only way to win the war on drugs is to remove the financial incentive. And I really feel like if your political rivals hadn't used and twisted your statements, used it against you, that Baltimore would be in a better situation now, both financially, because we wouldn't be spending as much money on locking people up, and as far as street violence goes, because that money could have been put into recreation centers and education.
Well, thank you very much. The change did come slowly. I remember that one congressman, after I made my initial comments, he, you know, called me the most dangerous man in America.
And, I remember that. Yeah.
And then later on, though, when again working with the community and with our the religious leaders here, we were able to implement the needle exchange program, which dramatically had a positive impact on reducing the spread of AIDS in Baltimore. That same congressman came back and said, you know, if we had done this a little earlier, you know, we could have had a more positive impact here in the community. And the other thing, unfortunately, is during President Clinton's time, when he signed that tough crime bill, anti-crime bill, they started to eliminate all the education grants for inmates.
Pell grants.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, totally counterproductive, you know, because if you want people to come out better, if you really want correctional institution to correct, you try to give folks an opportunity. It's not being soft on criminals. It's really being helpful to the community to have people get an education, come out job ready, rather than come out
you
and
know,
be dependent.
Those things really need to be addressed at the federal level. You could legalize marijuana in Maryland, it's still against federal laws.
That's right. And if the federal government decided it wanted to intervene, I mean, in all those states now, in Colorado and Washington, if the federal government wanted to change its mind, they would shut down all that activity.
Right. Also, I want to welcome onto the show Joseph Wood, who is the provost of the University of Baltimore, who teaches in the Division of Legal, Ethical, and Historical Studies. And we invited him in today because the University of Baltimore, where Kurt Schmoke is now president, is offering a course this fall called Divided Baltimore. How did we get here? Where do we go? Joseph Wood, welcome to the show. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
It's very interesting to me, the idea of studying Baltimore, the idea of, you know, coming out of the riot April 27th, right? So tell us about that, the idea of, you know, studying the city that you're in. And how do we get here? So where did this idea come from?
Lots of folks at the University of Baltimore have studied the city for a long time. Kurt will show you the Baltimore 68 book that came out of some research that was done a few years ago.
This is a look back at the riots 40 years ago?
That's right, yeah. Exactly. And a lot of
No, more than 40 years ago. 68. How many years ago was that now? 47 years ago.
Yeah.
Where am I?
That's right.
What year is this?
Yes.
Is that right? 47 years ago.
You got it.
That's right. And the Kerner Commission as well, which is from the same era, which talked a lot about problems in American cities. What's going on in Baltimore is, as we know from the news, is really no different than what's happening in a lot of other cities in the United States. And what we're seeing are manifestations. Freddie Gray is... and the experience around that is a manifestation of something that that happened in 68 and that we can trace back in terms of root causes well over a century.
Is Baltimore really no different than other cities? I mean, we're very high on per capita violence. Sure. Look at the population loss we've endured here over the last, 25 years.
Longer than that. We were, in 1950, we had 950,000 people. And so, you know, and when I was mayor, we started with about 750,000. One at the time I left, I think we were down another 50,000 people.
Yeah, I mean, really. I mean, that's you look at those numbers and you say, whoa.
Well, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. Cleveland's experiencing this. I've worked in Omaha, Nebraska. Omaha, Nebraska is experiencing this. Philadelphia experiences it. Detroit has certainly experienced it. It's not unique to Baltimore. Baltimore may have unique aspects of it, but the larger picture, the root causes of a lot of these problems date back over a century. And Tara Biatella wrote about this in Not in My Neighborhood. What the course is about.
I go back to at least 1960 or so when we look at Bethlehem Steel and the loss of industry over those years. That's number one. That's a significant thing because it affected mostly men who left high school or maybe even didn't finish high school, right, and could get a decent job that would probably guarantee them a road to the middle class, yeah, by the time they were in their late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah, Dan, I always tell audiences, that when I graduated high school in 1967, Bethlehem Steel was the largest employer in the metropolitan area. By the time I became mayor in 1987, Johns Hopkins was the largest private
this
employer.
This is 20 years.
Right. And so that symbolically shows you the change that occurred in the economy, and also it was a challenge to the school system because the dropout rate didn't change dramatically in the 20 years, but the implications of dropping out changed dramatically. You know, this course that Joe has put together with a group of our professors is going to be a little bit different than the one that, Maryland has, University of Maryland
Law School
has got one,
yeah.
Hopkins, Morgan, and Coppin. But we're going to do something that's on this model of a one-room schoolhouse model. We're actually going to invite not only our students, graduate and professional, but students in high school participate, and maybe some other colleges. It's going to be in the evening, 5:30 to 7:45 throughout the semester. We're going to use social media also and stream it. And so we'll have a curriculum. People will have opportunity to read about some things, but then come in and talk about solutions. And that's what the big thing is.
So that's the second oriented. The second part of it. The first part then is about how we got here.
How we got here. And it goes back certainly the deindustrialization and what happened with Bethlehem Steel, but even before that, on the west side, for instance, municipal ordinance in 1910 that effectively created geographical segregation, and even though it was overturned by Supreme Court in later years, covenants and redlining and all sorts of things were intentional efforts to create a segregated city. In which some neighborhoods found disinvestment and other neighborhoods found investment. What Kurt was just talking about a few moments ago in Sandtown, that's about now reinvesting in areas of tremendous disinvestment, but it's never quite enough. Meanwhile, we've also invested in things like the federal highway system that allowed people to escape Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
The story that you were talking about earlier in the hour that you wrote about in the paper this morning is an example of that. There's a particular sector that runs out along Reisterstown Road. I can show you the same pattern in Washington, D.C. I can show it to you in Cleveland. I can show it to
through
you
history. Over decades, right?
That sort of sectoral pattern that Ontario wrote about for Baltimore.
You're referring to Antero Piatella's book, Not in My Neighborhood,
exactly,
which came out maybe 6-7 years ago.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
dealt with those issues.
And created the history. So the point is that we are responding daily, and the media writes about daily manifestations of something that was intentional segregation. We've got to figure out how we break out of that wealth gap, the healthcare gap, all of the other issues that are part of that disinvestment.
It's very interesting to look at the history and say we're talking about Baltimore City, mm-hmm, right?
Right.
The segregation that occurred within the city, and in modern times we often think about segregation in terms of just the way we live as a region,
mm-hmm,
right?
Right.
A minority majority city surrounded by majority white suburbs, right?
Right.
But actually, in the history shows that this was occurring within the city limits over time, before we got to the Beltway and the Federal Highway Administration, all of that.
19th century, we were an integrated city.
We were an integrated city in the 1800s.
In the 1800s.
We're going to take a break here. We'll come back. Joseph Wood is the provost of the University of Baltimore. Kurt Schmoke is the president of UB, former mayor Kurt Schmoke. Questions and comments for our guests are welcome. A short break. This is a good time to call. I've got some emails to read. The phone number, 410-662-8780, and our email address, midday@wypr.org. Let's take some calls for Kurt Schmoke and also Joseph Wood, who is with us, the provost of the University of Baltimore, was here to tell us about this class. And before the hour's up, we'll tell you how you can enroll in it. Divided Baltimore, how did we get here? Where do we go? Be interested to see who signs up for that class. I'd be interested in taking that class myself. Don in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Go right ahead, please.
Yes, I'm calling with for Mr. Smoke. So, you know, I was a youth during his era as mayor of Baltimore, and a lot of it is blamed on him as far as the youth going to the streets, because as soon as Mr. Smoke got into office, all the recs were closed down, giving the kids nowhere else to go.
Rec centers during your time. I know you had to close some police, had to close some fire stations too, right?
A little bit of an exaggeration that all the recreation centers were closed down. That's not the case. There were many that were closed because of, unfortunately, recreation programs, unlike, let's say, public works, doesn't have its own stream of money. You know, you've got water rates, water fees and things like that that come in to the Department of Public Works that allow that department to continue. So what we did, we shifted to the police athletic centers, and the number of places where we had to close recreation centers, we were able to open PAL programs now, because PAL programs were funded primarily by foundations and local business. So that's why I was saying that the job of the mayor now is to be as creative as she can be in getting partnerships to open up some of these programs. And hopefully this will be on her agenda for the state if she can get some support for those types of programs. The other thing that I know that is on her agenda that would be very important are small grants to community-based organizations to help with youth programs, because Don is absolutely correct. If you can keep the young people involved, even if it's on a small local basis, then it's more likely you can keep people away from crime. But all the recreation centers were not closed.
But you were dealing with a shrinking tax base, probably like other mayors, right, where you had population loss when you lose middle-class, working-class people, people with decent incomes who can pay taxes, who own property. That starts to disappear. That shrinks.
Right.
That puts pressure on. That's not unique to Baltimore either, Joe Wood.
Correct. It's not. I mean, this is a national problem. We just happen to be experiencing attention to some of the manifestations at a higher level than we were a year ago.
Well,
it'll keep coming back until we resolve it.
And the high I went out to Cleveland one time when I was 1 year that I was mayor, and we did everything I thought possible to get under 300 homicides that year. And I looked and I saw Cleveland had 75 or 76 somewhere in there. I said, what is going on that's different there? And I went out and I looked physically, it was laid out differently. But the most important thing, the police chief told me out there and the mayor, they didn't have the concentration of poverty that we had. Half the state's welfare recipients lived in Baltimore City. That's a huge concentration of poverty that other cities didn't have, and it made a difference manifesting itself.
Today it's one in four of the population.
Yeah, so you can imagine now that most of our young people are responding to these problems by trying to get a good education. And you all reported earlier about these three young men from Carver High School that are getting an opportunity to go to Bethune-Cookman.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I thought that was wonderful. And that's an example of so many of our young people really are working to get an education, not to get in trouble. But it's a real challenge given the concentration of poverty in our community.
It's an email from Peter addressing the war on drugs and the drug trade. He says he thinks we now face the threat of a huge pushback from organized gangs, the organized drug trade, to prevent legalizations or decriminalization. I would suggest that this adds a level of complexity to the problem, which gets me to a question I want to ask you. Mm-hmm. So what would you do? I mean, if you could write a proposal to Congress, would you go for all the way for decriminalization of all these drugs, heroin?
I would start with marijuana.
Okay,
would be the start, because if you look at the arrest statistics, there are more people incarcerated because of marijuana than all these other drugs combined. And so I think that our state is moving in the right direction in terms of studying this problem, doing medical marijuana first, and then slowly decriminalizing possession of small amounts of marijuana. I think that that is would be a huge step forward. And then in terms of the other drugs, I would regulate it depending upon their ability to do harm. And so something like, well, I don't know if PCP is still around, but there's certain drugs that just do more damage to the human body than others. And, but I would, again, have it regulated by the health officials, not by law enforcement.
Do you think that violence, some of the violence we see is associated with the marijuana trade?
I think it's drug trade generally, and it, but it starts with the marijuana market.
Okay, so if you legalize marijuana, let's say Congress actually did it throughout the country, people could purchase marijuana from stores. You'd have marijuana growers like we're seeing in Colorado,
right?
And you would eliminate the street sales. You would eliminate competition over corners.
That's right.
And possibly violence.
And you would still have some level of violence, but you just would it would start to decrease the amount of violence and the wars over profit, because most of the shooting has to do with control of money, control of markets. These are not guys that are taking drugs and going crazy and then shooting somebody. These are people fighting about control of markets. So I've said for many years, there are a lot of people that are hooked on drugs, but there are a lot more that are hooked on drug money.
Yes, and Michael makes this point in an email. He says, I'm in favor of decriminalization and drug treatment, but addressing these issues in isolation neglects the bigger issue. What will the young people do for employment if the drug trade dries up? I'd rather have a young man dealing on the corner than breaking down my back door.
Yeah, I don't think it's an either-or, Dan.
Yeah.
That's the thing about it.
I mean, they could theoretically go to work, couldn't they? Work in a marijuana store.
Just think about it. I mean,
that's not that far-fetched, is it?
So many of our young people, though, they are working hard. It's not... the vast majority of our young people that are out on corners doing this.
No.
Most of the kids are there trying to get an education and getting decent jobs. And again, back to the city-state thing, when the red line when the governor decided against the red line, I had hoped that he would come out or the state would come out with a robust proposal on transportation, because if you can move young people to the jobs that are in this, suburban areas where you don't have to spend 2-3 hours
trying to get to work,
but can, get on a shuttle and go, man, that would make such a big difference.
Yeah.
And that's easy. That is not a burden on taxpayers. That's not city, county fighting one another, you know. So it's those kind of ideas that working together can make a big difference.
Time for one more quick call here. Tom in Mount Vernon, go right ahead. You're on with Kurt Schmoke.
Hi, this is Tom. This is for President Smoot. I was wondering, sir, would you consider coming back as mayor for one term and in order to bring a statesman instead of a politician into the system?
So would you consider running for mayor again?
No, I'm what you call a recovering politician. I work at it every day. I think that we've got some really good people out here with some great ideas. But again, it's a matter of folks taking a step back a little bit and remembering that we can solve these problems. If we work together, when we had problems with housing back in the 90s, we worked together and, solved a lot of that. But that was working with the community.
You can't give up.
No, and it's a regional issue. Folks who might have thought were in the surrounding suburbs and might have thought we had a drug problem that was only a city problem, and now they're dealing with it. That's what I'm saying. It's a regional problem. We can work together and solve these things.
Kurt Schmoke is president of the University of Baltimore. Joseph Wood is the provost of UB. If folks are interested in the class, Divided Baltimore, how did we get here? Where do we go? When does it start, by the way?
It starts on Monday, the 31st of August.
Oh, okay. It's coming up.
And it'll be every Monday other than Labor Day, of course.
Is there a limit to the enrollment, or is it going to be in a big hall?
Well, we're doing two things. There will be enrolled students, but the community is invited to attend.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, that's cool. It's called Divided Baltimore. You just go to the website for the University of Baltimore for information.
Correct.
Very good. Thank you for being here, Joseph Wood. Nice to meet you. And Kurt Schmoke, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Dan.
Yeah, good luck at the growing University of Baltimore.
Absolutely.
Next time you get back, we'll talk some more about UB. Okay?
That's great. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in to the first hour. Stay with us. Got another hour coming up of Midday. It's Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell.